That is the sound of a caterpillar munching on a leaf. This chomping sound was recorded using a technique called laser vibrometry, which allows us to hear the vibrations that travel through a plant while a caterpillar is eating. We're not the only ones who can hear this. Neighboring plants hear it too, and as you might guess, it scares them. More on this business of plants hearing things and being scared in just a second. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we're talking to a couple of scientists at the University of Missouri who study plant communication, how plants talk and listen to each other, to animals, and even us. Let's start by talking with Heidi Apple, whose research brings us the caterpillar sounds we've just been hearing. Good morning, Heidi.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. It's so useful for radio to have the sounds. It's wonderful. What inspired you to record the sound of caterpillars eating?
Well, my collaborator, Rex Cocroft, is a bioacoustician who studies how insects communicate with each other when they're on plants. And he one day was complaining to me about how he had to scrap an experiment because there was a feeding caterpillar on it. Now, I'm someone who studies how plants respond to insects. We both kind of looked at each other and went, no, you don't think that the plant could be using this information. And that's how the idea was hatched.
So how did you use these recordings in your lab?
What we did was to make recordings of a number of different caterpillars and then play them back to the plants in the absence of the actual damage. And this was important to do because plants have many different ways to tell they're being attacked, just like we do. When we get a wound, we have lots of signals that happen. And vibrations are just one, but they're a very early one and a very fast one. And so we needed to isolate the effect of feeding vibrations from all of the other wound responses.
In order to figure out whether the plant was quote-unquote hearing what was happening and responding strictly to the sound.
Exactly.
So what did you observe? What happened?
So when we treated leaves with the vibrations of caterpillar feeding and then later challenged them with the real insects, those plants that had received the feeding vibrations made many more chemical defenses.
Interesting. So the sound alone produced a stronger response?
Yes, about 33 to 5 times more response.
And what is the response? Okay. What do you mean by a response?
Well, plants defend themselves primarily by chemistry, and it's a chemistry that's very familiar to us. We take advantage of it as herbs and spices and natural medicines. And this chemistry, though, evolved to protect plants against their pests, like insects and diseases. And so plants are known, and this is something that my husband, Jack Schultz, actually discovered, that plants induce and make more of these chemicals when they're attacked by insects.
And we'll be talking to him shortly, but please go on.
So we knew that they would make more responses when they're attacked by the insect, but they actually made more than they would have otherwise if they received the feeding vibrations first.
Why do you think that is?
Well, there's a phenomenon in plants called priming, where they receive some sort of signal that's not deadly, but is kind of a warning signal of a pest or pathogen that's around. And what that does is prime their genetic machinery so that when the attack actually occurs and it's serious, they can respond more quickly.
What do the oils do to, say, a caterpillar?
The mustard oils are repellent to a lot of insects that don't use that kind of plant regularly as food. So they won't recognize the food or they'll come and nibble and walk away.
Wow. So they can respond to the sound of a nearby caterpillar eating a nearby leaf, even if it's not really happening, just the sound of it, by producing chemicals that would be harmful to that predator.
Yes, and we've shown that happens within a plant. So the vibrations are played back to one leaf and the other side of the plant can feel it too and makes more chemistry. But we don't know yet whether it communicates to an adjacent plant, say if their leaves are touching. And that's one of the things we're going to study this summer.
So can we just step back and unpack this a little bit? There are a lot of implications here that might be surprising to people. First off, that plants hear things. Can you explain in more detail this hearing plants do?
Sure. We hear through air born vibrations, okay? And then our ear translates that into mechanical movement that is then transmitted as a signal to our brain. Plants, though, don't have hearing organs like we do, and so all of their perception of sound happens through what we call substrate-borne vibrations. So they vibrate themselves. It's much like if you feel you got the bass cranked up and you can feel the bass. That is how caterpillars perceive the world, but they perceive it at a whole range of frequencies, not just the low ones. So there's high and low.
So I'm sorry, is it the caterpillars who are doing the hearing? It's the plants, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then would you characterize the production of these protective oils as a stress response that's in maybe some way similar to like the stress response that we experience? Or is that projecting too much emotion onto what's happening?
If you mean stress in an emotional sense, I have no basis to suggest that plants experience stress emotionally, but they certainly respond to stressful situations by changing their behavior. And they will, you know, change how much they grow, where they grow, above ground or below ground, and all kinds of chemistry that defends them against various kinds of stresses.
What kinds of things are stressful to plants?
Well, certainly being eaten is stressful. Not having enough water, not having enough nutrients, having a disease show up. Plants are coated with tons of different pathogens that just sit on the leaf surface and don't do any harm because they can't get in. But once a cut or damage is made on a leaf, much like when we get wounded, we have to worry about infection. Plants then go through a series of hoops to thwart the pathogen.
The University of Missouri's press materials are saying that this will help farmers and people like that to protect plants from insects. And from a pragmatic standpoint, that's definitely significant. But is there a deeper, like, philosophical significance to consider as well? This really seems to go against most people's ideas about what it means to be a plant.
Yes, we perennially underestimate plants. And if I can steal a phrase that Jack uses often, plants are just slow animals. They're behaving, but they're not behaving in ways that are familiar to us as mammals. So they are moving as they grow and reach for things. And there's some very fast movement in the plant world, like carnivorous plants, where there are traps that happen.
Like in Little Shop
quickly.
Of Horrors.
Exactly. But much of their behavior is invisible to us because it's either chemical or it happens on a slower time scale. And we generally don't have the patience to watch it.
Well, speaking of Jack, I'd like to talk to him. He happens to be your husband, but Jack Schultz is at the University of Missouri, where he's been researching plant communication, and he's been researching that for decades. Welcome to Central Standard, Jack.
Nice to be here.
What kinds of things do plants need to talk to each other about, and what are some examples of how they do that?
Well, the examples you got from Heidi are really a good place to start. Insects attack plants. Plants respond chemically, as Heidi's been telling you.
And what are some examples of plants that do that, and how do they do it?
All plants do it. Have you had coffee this morning?
Yeah.
Well, then you've had a dose of insecticide. That's what caffeine is doing there.
Yikes.
And coffee plants will increase the amount of caffeine they produce if they're wounded, attacked by an insect, and sometimes attacked by disease. The insect has to provide some kind of cue, and besides the vibrations Heidi's been studying, the best evidence is that there's something in the saliva of insects that tells the plant it's being attacked and turns on genes that are necessary to produce the chemicals that defend it.
Whoa, okay. And I have heard that there's something about that fresh-cut grass smell.
Yeah, right. One of the chemicals, or one of the kinds of chemicals that plants produce when they're being attacked by insects are what we call volatiles. That just means odors, things that, you know, travel through the air. One of the most important ones is something called methyl jasminate, and the name suggests that it's the odor of jasmine flowers, which it is. It turns out that's a very active plant hormone that turns on defenses. And when a plant is attacked by an insect, it coordinates its defense responses using that molecule and releases a lot of it into the air, where it travels to other plants and turns on their defenses.
So that smell of fresh cut grass, how would you characterize what we should be interpreting there? I mean, so many people love that smell, but it sounds unpleasant for the plants.
Well, it's the grass crying for help. The help comes in the form of friendly insects and even birds that are attracted to those odors and in doing so find the enemy attacking the plant and consume it usually. So the plants are actually cooperating with predators and parasites that would have a hard time finding those pest insects otherwise. The plant is saying, hey, over here, you can smell it. It's right here on my leaf.
You know what I just realized? This is a horrible realization. I hope that I'm wrong, but it sounds like maybe when you're muddling spices and they emit their wonderful fragrances, you're making plants cry.
Well, the spices are already kind of an extract. I think it's too late for those plants.
Good point.
But it is true. And, you know, as Heidi pointed out a few minutes ago, we really don't give plants credit for doing these kinds of things. And there's an enormous amount of information flying through the air all around us in the form of chemical signals that everybody but us can interpret.
There's a human idea about communing with nature, which makes me want to believe that a plant's life is not stressful. And I especially want to believe that I do not create stress for plants. Am I just going to have to get used to the idea? Or are there ways, I don't know, are humans just universally going to do things that are stressful to plants?
Well, even without humans, I think the average plant is living a stressful life. You know, all the things it needs are usually in short supply. In fact, that's very important in feeding the world. Plant production, and that means food production, is limited pretty much everywhere on the planet by either the amount of water available or the amount of nutrients available. And what that essentially means is that all those plants are stressed most of the time. You know, sometimes we do help them out. Fertilization makes them less stressed. Watering makes them less stressed. So you're not entirely evil. I mean, we help them when we get a chance. But yeah, it's a stressful thing being a plant. I mean, and think of it, as you said in your wonderful introduction, they can't run away. You know, you and I, if we're feeling stressed, we can go home and pout. But the plant is stuck rooted in one place, and so it's got to be able to deal.
Tell me about some of the earliest research you published on plants having the ability to communicate with one another. It had to do with maple trees, right?
Yeah, maples and poplars, actually. We were studying the kinds of changes in chemistry that Heidi described, that is the increase in defenses, things like nicotine, caffeine, those are all defenses. And we were studying their increase when insects attack plants.
What year is this?
This is about 1980.
Okay, go on.
Okay. And the correct way to do that experiment, of course, is to treat some plants with insects, and you have control plants that are not treated, and you measure something after the treatment. Either
what do you mean by treat?
Put insects on, let them eat.
Okay.
Okay. So imagine you have two tomato plants. You want to know if the plant changes in response to the insect. You put insects on one plant and measure some changes. You compare those changes to the plant that has not been attacked, and you say, oh, yeah, something changed. The insect must have caused it. That makes sense?
Yeah. So then the plant that is not having direct exposure to the insect is getting its information from some other thing.
Yeah. The confusing result that people were getting was that if you put your control plants, your untreated plants, too close to the treated plants, they would respond as though they had been treated. Whereas the plants farther away would be unchanged because they were not only not being treated, but they were far away from the treatment.
What were the implications of this to you?
Well, that there had to be some signaling among the plants. The question was, how is that happening? And if you do that kind of experiment outdoors, there's always the possibility that signals could travel below ground, you know, from roots to roots. You know, in nature, most plants in a natural community are attached one way or another by the roots, and so they can talk to each other that way. So you had to rule that out, and the way to do that is put them in pots.
Put them in pots?
Put them in pots. Put them in a room. Damage one set of plants. Don't damage the other set of plants. If everybody's in a pot, they're not talking to each other below ground through the roots or anything. So the only possibility is that there is a signal traveling through the air when the plants nearby turn on.
Wow. This is really fascinating stuff, but Talk to me about the initial mainstream response to your findings. I hear you got off kind of on the wrong foot with this idea in the public sphere.
That's sort of true. Actually, the public wasn't so bad. The public kind of enjoyed it, but that's a problem among scientists sometimes. At the time, talking with folks like you, friendly investigators interested in what science is doing, was looked down upon by a lot of scientists.
Why is that?
Well, I think they think that you have to dumb it down in order to make it understandable to the public. They think that you somehow don't do full credit to the science if you have to simplify it. And so there were two responses. One was a great deal of interest in the popular media. We were featured in People magazine, the front page of the New York Times. The very first reporter I ever spoke to didn't identify himself, and I was too naive to ask. So the first place that published a story on that particular finding was the National Enquirer.
Not great PR among academics.
That's exactly right. And so the academic side looked at that and said, oh, this can't be serious. Because after all, it was a very, very strange finding. I was very doubtful myself. I really combed the literature to find some evidence that plants could do that kind of thing. And there simply wasn't any. It was absolutely brand new.
So that makes you question yourself as a scientist. I mean, how do you just have to keep repeating the experiment until you can't find any other explanation?
That's right. The scientists like to say that an extraordinary finding requires extraordinary evidence. So, you know, the science part of it had to be really tight, had to be really convincing. And again, scientists, you know, they don't give the public credit for being convinced in the same way they are. So when you see it in the popular media, then scientists get a little skeptical. But yeah, you have to do it until it's totally convincing.
Has the scientific community evolved in its response to this information since then? I mean, is there more willingness to pursue this line of inquiry now than 30-some years ago?
Absolutely. In fact, that story is a textbook staple now. I mean, it's universally understood that plants are doing this kind of thing. It did take several other investigators to corroborate our findings. I mean, you know, it's even more powerful if two people, different people, particularly skeptics, find the same result. And over time, that happened. More instances of that phenomenon were discovered. For example, drought stress also causes the plant to emit a particular set of odors, and other plants can perceive that. And then they respond as though they're drought stressed. So almost anything that happens to a plant, as it turns out, causes the plant to produce these kinds of signals, and other plants nearby can appreciate that.
This is all still pretty mind-blowing to me, and I guess this is maybe because of the language that we use. Words like stress do have that emotional tenor, but would you deduce from your research that plants feel things, or is this a chain of chemical events that aren't about a sensory and by sensory, I guess, on some level, sentient existence?
Well, even the scientific community is divided on that issue. You will find articles about, you know, that sort of extend these observations to a more, you know, cognitive place for plants. Personally, I don't think that's very profitable. I think we can understand everything that's happening in terms of, you know, molecular interactions and physical interactions between insects and plants. I don't think you have to go into the sentient area to understand this. I mean, admittedly, they are way more complicated and do much more sophisticated things than most of us know. But, you know, that's true of all of nature. It's all pretty complicated, and it doesn't make it sentient.
Central Standard is off to a break. When we return, more on the story of the husband-wife team studying plant communication at the University of Missouri and just what we should do with this information. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard. Later in the show, we'll be gathering recommendations for great places to eat north of the river. You can start calling 816-235-2255. 1-800-522-8888 with your favorite gems. We'll be taking those calls in the next segment of the show. For now, we're hearing, surprising to me anyway, information about what plants know about their surroundings and how they communicate that information with each other. Our guests are a husband and wife research team at the forefront of this stuff. Heidi Apple, good morning again.
Good morning.
And Jack C. Schultz, hello again to you.
Hi, Gina.
How did you guys meet?
Oh. Well, shall I tell a story?
Yes, please.
I was a graduate student and Jack was a young assistant professor. And we showed up at a meeting together in which I was reporting work that I had been doing on caterpillar guts. And I was actually describing some particular aspects of them that influence what those chemicals do from plants once they get inside the insect. And we got into a debate over single malt scotches on these aspects of the caterpillar guts. And after the meeting, I received an email saying, well, I really don't believe you've measured this, but why don't you come out to my lab and check it out? And, you know, we'll measure stuff with your equipment and with my equipment, and we'll see who's right.
So this courtship began over caterpillar guts. Jack, anything
That's
you'd
right.
like to add?
No, it took a lot of guts to get together, though.
Because you had to keep measuring them. I'm fascinated,
That's
Jack,
right.
that you were skeptical of the findings.
Well, actually, it's a little complicated, but the color of the caterpillar poop that Heidi was getting in her studies was completely different from the color of the caterpillar poop I was getting, and that meant that something really different chemically had to be going on as that stuff passed through the caterpillar, and I just couldn't believe that it could work the way she said.
I was right.
We were both right. You can get both colors the same way.
That is an unusual courtship story. I love it. Do you guys garden? Like, do you have house plants? I'm curious, with all of your knowledge, if that is a different experience in your home than in mine.
Well, I think Heidi would agree that I tend to treat house plants as pets. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't take them for walks, but... But they're very kind of special to me. I really hate to lose one. And it's an emotional thing if somebody's not doing well in the garden.
Heidi, I've seen you in a video from the university talking about your findings, and you're surrounded by potted cacti and it looks like little tanks with some plant life in them. And I don't know if that's part of your studies, but it's not in the lab. And I'm wondering about your relationship to plants outside the lab.
Well, Jack's the master plant caretaker at home and does a fantastic job of it. So I've focused my own efforts on my university office. And there I have a number of different cacti, which, of course, require little care. So when I get distracted by some new exciting project, they can go on their own. And then I also have a carnivorous plant tank, which has inside it some of the real notorious eaters.
So that's why they're in a tank, because they're carnivorous.
It's dangerous to let them out. No, as it turns out, they can live just fine without predators, without, you know, insect prey in them. And I have about six different kinds in that tank. And I have them there because they make me happy. And just looking at them and being amazed at the things plants can do. So I have Venus fly traps, I have pitcher plants.
Would you just say that plants communicate through beauty? I mean, is that intended to have an effect on humans?
Well, we have selected plants over time to be more beautiful to us. And, you know, that's the whole basis of the horticultural industry. So while plants on their own, facing their own stresses, are not going to take our notion of beauty into account, we can force that through breeding so that they have traits that we find especially beautiful. And we do that with a lot with flowers, with leaf texture, et cetera.
Central Standard will be right back.